Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
This was another one of those days when about all you could do was take a deep breath, sit firmly back in your chair, and grab the armrest tightly, while the financial world around us kept unwinding. Markets plunged, Europe's mess grew, and our lawmakers go right on bickering. Let's try to get a grip on it all, shall we? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by FreshBooks, an online invoicing service for freelancers and small businesses designed to help save time, look professional, and make invoicing easy. More at FreshBooks.com. And by MassMutual, offering retirement and 401k plans to businesses for more than 60 years. MassMutual.com/retirestrong.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Bob Moon in for Kai Rizdahl. Thanks for making us a part of your Thursday, this 22nd of September. A day I can sum up in one word: ugh. Investors were grunting today over plunging stocks, oil, even gold. Prices of seemingly everything except U.S. Treasury bonds tumbled around the world. There was worrying economic data out of China, and a French official was quoted as saying 16 European banks will be ordered to shore up their cash reserves at once. Mostly, though, yesterday's move by the Fed to prime the U.S. economic pump seems to have done more immediate harm than good. As Stacey Vanek-Smith reports, the Fed's words spoke louder than its actions.
The Federal Reserve unveiled Operation Twist yesterday, but today it was the why that had investors worried. Jack Ablin is chief investment officer for Harris Private Bank.
When you have the nation's largest economic cheerleader say that there's significant downside to their forecasts, that sends shivers out there.
The Fed's exact words were, quote, "There are significant downside risks to the economic outlook, including strains in global financial markets." That's Fed speak for the economy is looking worse. And the plan itself, buying $400 billion worth of long-term bonds, may not do much to change that. Investment advisor Gary Schilling calls it
a clear revelation that the Fed has run out of ammunition.
At a time when there's no shortage of economic threats, unemployment, a depressed housing market, political gridlock, not to mention the situation in Europe. Fear that all of those things will lead to another recession is what's really plaguing the markets, says Georgetown finance professor James Angel.
And when the Fed came out and said, yeah, it's bad out there, everybody said, oh, no.
Angel says investors were looking for reassurance from the Fed yesterday.
When the Fed says there's going to be continued weakness in the economy, and it's so weak that we're going into another major Fed operation here, that in itself is a signal.
A signal confirming investors' fears. A little bit like the Fed saying, actually, America, that dress does make you look fat. In New York, I'm Stacey Vanek-Smith for Marketplace.
The quest for a fix is now focused on a gathering over the next 2 days of the so-called G20, leaders of the top developed and developing nations. It's part of the annual meeting of the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank. The topic? What else? The worsening European debt crisis and what to do about it. John Lipsky is an economist and a special advisor to IMF Managing Director Christine Lagarde. Welcome, sir.
Thank you.
We woke up this morning to some ongoing bad news, global markets down. This comes after the IMF put out a report that the global economy is entering a dangerous new phase. Should the markets be this fearful?
Well, I'm not in the business of second-guessing markets, but advanced economies are growing too slowly to make a dent in their high unemployment rates, and some emerging economies are growing rapidly enough they're running into some inflationary challenges. So we need rebalancing, and what is required is clarity of vision on the part of policymakers and straightforward action.
Now, is it realistic, though, to expect all these different political interests, particularly in Europe, to find a solution to this?
Europe's problems are eminently manageable, and they have, in fact, elicited some strong new policy initiatives over the past year and a half that are often undervalued or overlooked. But there are still challenges ahead. One, to deal with the budgetary challenges that face many of the European economies. Secondly, to bolster the banks that face potential weaknesses because of the problems of their government finances. And third, to complete the governance reforms in the Eurozone that will give greater confidence to investors and others.
But how? How does that happen?
Oh, well, it's first of all governments in the Eurozone have committed in the past months to new fiscal initiatives that would produce better balance. The challenge is to make those plans concrete.
I wish I had a nickel for all the times I've heard the word challenges come up in this conversation so far. You have said rather recently that you didn't think we were at risk of entering a global recession. Has that view changed, and why or why not?
Global growth is actually a bit better than the long-term average, but the problem, as I said earlier, is the distribution is wrong, and given the level of unused capacity in advanced economies and level of unemployment.
Unused capacity, what does that mean to our average listener?
Plant that is idle, workers that are unemployed who want to be employed, that's an easy one to look at, but also productive capacity that is not fully used and could be used without creating inflation pressures.
So what I think I hear you saying is still no global recession?
That's correct. If the policy initiatives that underpin our forecast are put in place.
Given this intensifying crisis, has the role of the IMF intensified as well?
Yes, I think that's fair enough to say. There have been a substantial increase in the financial resources available to the fund to be able to respond to the challenges.
So making loans.
Exactly. And new initiatives in analysis and discussion and interaction with our members to strengthen our understanding of systemic issues, and in particular the way that the financial system internationally interacts with the real economy.
I must say, Mr. Lipsky, that you're much more optimistic than I've been hearing from other quarters.
Well, I don't know who you've been talking to, but our view is pretty clear. There are significant challenges, there are significant risks, but there are policies available to meet the challenges. They're not simple, they're not easy, they require focus. They require political will, and above all, they require international cooperation. And that exactly is the theme of the annual meetings here.
I think maybe the subtle difference here is that you think that there is the political will.
I believe so. It's very clearly in everyone's interest to both cooperate and to act.
John Lipsky is a special advisor to the International Monetary Fund. Thank you for joining us, sir.
Thank you.
Tell you what, let's just hold off on the gory details from Wall Street until we do the numbers. HP is supposed to stand for Hewlett-Packard, but it might as well be short for Hot Pink, which is the color of those little slips HP's board of directors keeps handing out to chief executives. The high-tech giant just fired its third CEO in a row, and this afternoon it handed the reins to the former head of eBay, Meg Whitman. Years ago, HP chose a single word, invent, as its slogan. But as Marketplace's Jeff Tyler reports, it's been struggling lately to reinvent itself.
Hewlett-Packard is the world's largest technology company. Among other things, it sells printers and computers. But high-tech analyst Gary Arlen says HP's business model is changing.
HP has given signals that it's going to get out of the personal computer business. And it's sort of a signal that the PC business overall is nearing the end of its lifespan as we knew it.
Arlen says HP is following in the footsteps of IBM, which went from making computers to providing computing services. Arlen says HP faces big obstacles.
Does a company that has been hardware-oriented for its entire existence have the resources, the internal capabilities, the staffing to be a services company?
Morningstar analyst Michael Holt believes Hewlett-Packard has what it takes. The problem, he says, has been a lack of leadership. Meg Whitman will be the company's fourth CEO in the past 6 years. Outgoing CEO Leo Apotheker lasted less than a year. On his watch, the stock lost nearly half its value. Holt says investors have given up on HP.
They've lost confidence in the company. And what I mean by that is they don't have a sense for where HP is trying to go. And every time HP sets a goal, they miss it or change it. And so there's no credibility left.
As eBay CEO, Whitman built the company into a powerhouse. The question now is whether she can take HP, a former powerhouse, and restore it. I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
Maybe Wall Street didn't quite see it this way, but that plan unveiled by the Fed yesterday is supposed to breathe some new life into the critical housing market. Critical in all senses of the word. The Fed is aiming to push down long-term interest rates to make things like mortgages even more attractive. But as Marketplace's Nancy Marshall Genzer reports, it's one thing for the Fed to drive rates down, and quite another for consumers to actually buy a new home.
Mortgage rates are already at the lowest level in 40 years, and the housing market is still in the dumps. So a day after the Fed's big announcement, the reviews are not good.
It's not going to work. It's really going to be a pretty small effect, I think.
But low rates aren't going to solve the problem.
That was economist Anthony Sanders, former Fed economist Ken Kuttner, and financial analyst Greg McBride. McBride, who's at Bankrate.com, says people are too scared to buy a house now, no matter how low the interest rate.
People aren't buying houses because they're worried about a recession or their own job security.
The consensus is fix the economy, then people will plunk their cash down on new houses. But maybe ultra-low mortgage rates will spark a wave of refinancing. Our former Fed economist Ken Kuttner doesn't think so, because banks won't refinance people with shaky credit or who owe more than their homes are worth.
That's something where I think banks have probably become much more conservative in the past couple of years.
And you can't force banks to lend or refinance a loan. Some economists want the government to revamp its refinancing programs. The thinking is more refinancing would lower monthly mortgage payments. Then consumers would have billions of dollars more to spend. But economist Anthony Sanders at George Mason University says that might not happen. Even if a refi saved a family $400 a month, they might stash the cash just in case.
$400 a month is a lot of money. The bad news is that if you've lost your job, that may not be enough.
In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall Genzer for Marketplace.
Don't bother stopping me because I know we've heard this one before. Congress is scrambling to avoid a government shutdown. This has already played out and been narrowly averted twice this year. Now lawmakers are paralyzed over how to pay for disaster relief. Congress is on recess next week, so if there's no agreement over this weekend, the federal lights go out on October 1st, which has businesses wondering and worrying anew whether total government dysfunction is now the new normal. Marketplace's David Gurrow reports.
Karen Petru advises big banks and private equity investors. She's paid to explain the ways of Washington.
What they want to know is what is the government going to do,
so they can figure out how to invest their money. These days, Petru's clients are confounded by Congress.
Bringing the country to the brink for fun, essentially, is viewed by at least the business people we speak with as enraging.
Government contractors are most directly on the hook.
If there is a shutdown, this is the sector of the economy that gets hit the hardest.
That's Stan Soloway. He heads the Professional Services Council, a contractor trade association. Soloway says these companies need predictability they're not getting.
So from any sort of business perspective, that creates tremendous challenges.
They're worried about getting paid now and in the future. As the government fights over long-term funding, contracts are up in the air. Dan Mextroth is with the Manufacturers Alliance. He says this holdup in contracts has a ripple effect from the government to contractors to other companies.
Whether they're directly related to the government contract or they're just in the supply chain of a government contract.
Because manufacturers make a lot of the components government contractors use. This is really all about how to get companies to invest and grow. And Karen Petru says that's hard with this, the new normal.
The money, prudent money, is on the sidelines, and I don't know how to get it out until Congress can get its act together.
In Washington, I'm David Gura for Marketplace.
Coming up, what Israelis see as security checkpoints, Palestinians view as a roadblock to something else.
For the ability for us to create an efficient economy, that's a disaster.
The push for an independent Palestine. But first, let's do the numbers. Back to new lows. The Dow Jones Industrial Average plunged 391 points, 3.5%, to wrap up at 10,733. The NASDAQ took off 82 points, 3.25%, to close at 2455. The S&P 500 lost 37 points, 3.1%, to finish at 1129. All 30 Dow stocks finished in the red today. Fears of renewed global recession dented companies that drive construction. U.S. Steel crumpled more than 11%. Rio Tinto and Freeport-McMoRan each lost about 10%. Alcoa sliced off 6.75%. Hewlett-Packard stock came crashing back down today, losing nearly 5%. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note hit a record low today, settling at 1.72%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by T. Rowe Price, understanding the connections of a complex global economy. T. Rowe Price, invest with confidence at TRoePrice.com. By Indiana University's Kelley School of Business, providing a personalized approach to career advancement. Learn more at kellei.iu.edu. And by Ally Bank, offering IRA savings products and a Raise Your Rate 4-year CD. Learn more at allybank.com. If you missed the broadcast, you can still catch Marketplace. Go to our website and click on Podcasts. You'll also find our new podcasts, The Midday Update, Freakonomics, and The Tech Report, all at marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Friday. A House Subcommittee on Health holds a hearing to examine the cause and effects of drug shortages in the healthcare system. The Congressional Black Caucus Foundation continues its annual legislative conference in Washington. And pull out those fashionable boots and coats. Tomorrow is the first day of fall. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM, American Public Media. I'm Bob Moon in for Kai Ryssdal. The weight of the world rests upon the United Nations as the General Assembly continues its meetings in New York. So far, we've heard speeches on the Arab Spring and the global economy, but there are other pressing topics getting attention, such as soda pop. More than that, of course, what should the UN's response be to the obesity epidemic? Costly health consequences are on the rise in countries rich and poor. Commentator Raj Patel says there's a way to curb the crisis, but it requires a coordinated push.
Bigger isn't always better. By 2030, half of Americans won't just be overweight, but obese. And by then, nearly a fifth of our healthcare dollars will be spent treating the diseases that come with being bigger. Our lifestyles, rich in fat, sugar, and inactivity, are creating a debt that'll become the planet's most expensive public health issue. So what to do? One battle centers on how to make us better eaters, and especially better drinkers. Half of the sugar in US diets comes from sweetened beverages. Advocates of what gets called a soda tax look like they've got a strong case. Tax the sugar in the drink, and the consumption goes down, right? Well, yes, but a study from Northwestern University recently found that overweight people prefer diet drinks. You can almost hear the soda industry snickering. But this oughtn't to make us give up on the idea of taxation in the name of public health. Think about tobacco. A dollar tax on a pack of cigarettes makes some people smoke less, but that's not the only thing that we've done to curb smoking. We've changed regulation to target not just cigarettes, but anything containing tobacco. We limited marketing to children. We've confronted the companies who profit from tobacco with a coherent public health push and made them pay for their ill-gotten gains. So why can't taxes, together with other ideas, work with sugar? One in three kids born in America today will develop some form of diabetes. One in two kids of color. A meaningful soda tax, say a penny per ounce on sugary drinks, is an important part of a bigger policy strategy. We can, for example, take back the billions we spend subsidizing commodity and processed food production and give it to those most harmed by these products. This isn't the nanny state as much as it is a response to the wild excesses of the market, just leveling the playing field away from big food so we'll have fewer big people.
Raj Patel is the author of The Value of Nothing. We always value your comments. Send them our way at marketplace.org. Speaking of which,
I'm going to sit right down and write myself a letter.
Last week, we aired a piece on the new ICD-10 codes. Those are the shorthands that hospitals and clinics use to bill insurance carriers for medical treatments. The old system had about 18,000 codes. The new one has close to eight times that, denoting everything from injuries that occur in opera houses to someone walking into a lamppost. Dr. Andrew Solomon from Seattle, Washington, wants to share his pain.
I can easily see it taking an hour or more a day to just input the appropriate diagnostic codes. It's important that we have biostatistical information. But, you know, being burned by water skis on fire, really, that's not useful information.
This whole European financial crisis thing is beginning to have an eerily familiar ring. We reported that a rogue trader at UBS made Swiss cheese out of $2 billion in bank funds. If you remember, that same thing happened to a French bank, Société Générale, back in 2008. Leona Clarer from Stamford, Connecticut, wrote in to pose this question.
I was wondering, where is that money? Where did it go?
For the answer, here's the Marketplace whiteboard guy. Take it away, Patty Hirsch.
It looks as though this loss happened in a series of trades over a long period of time. It got spread out really across the entire financial system. You could have some of it in your 401k. That is conceivable.
Oh, I feel so much better now. And finally, a few listeners, male, I might add, wrote in after Kai said the Ford Taurus police interceptor is the new car of choice for the black and whites driven by our nation's finest. He also said, and this is what most of you have issues with, that the interceptor just doesn't sound all that threatening compared to its predecessor, the Crown Vic. Enter Adam Gage of Tampa, Florida, who says, Bull, the Taurus has already proven its mettle.
Given that the Ford Taurus was used as the official police car in all of the RoboCop movies, I think it is certainly tough enough.
Got a pop culture reference you want to share or anything else? Go to marketplace.org and click on the link that says Contact. The much-awaited speech from Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas is set tomorrow at the UN. He'll plead with the member nations to recognize a state of Palestine. Israel and the U.S. oppose the move, insisting that the Palestinians first need to sit down at peace talks. But many predict Palestine will win UN recognition. Palestinian leaders say they're building the institutions needed for a full-fledged government and economy. Are they ready? Daniel Estrin went to the West Bank city of Ramallah to find out.
You can learn a lot about the Palestinian economy today from this one phone call. Hazem Aideh works for Safad, a Palestinian wholesaler of Microsoft and HP products. His printer cartridges and laptops arrive at the Israeli port on the Mediterranean coast. He's on the phone almost every day talking to the Israelis who run the port.
Shalom.
Hazem.
How are you?
They make small talk. They laugh.
I don't know how it will help you, but...
But Aida says every phone call is about dealing with delays.
I want to ask you about the two files that you sent me today.
The usual holdup? Israeli army checks to make sure his computer equipment can't be used to disrupt Israeli military communication systems. That can take weeks and even months. He says the army's regulations are always changing.
All our life is related to the Israeli rules, you know.
Israel controls imports and exports, a source of frustration for the Palestinians. But it hasn't stopped software and IT sectors in the West Bank from booming. It wasn't like this 6 years ago at the tail end of the Palestinian uprising. But when the U.S. trained the Palestinian security forces, things started to change. Raed Elayan is a Palestinian businessman.
You feel secure. You know that someone is protecting you there.
This newfound sense of law and order allows businesses to thrive.
Hello?
Hello, marhaba.
It convinced Elayan last year to launch his own company, an internet service provider. Today, he operates a 24-hour support center. Nowadays, around Ramallah, you'll see a bunch of shiny new cash machines. Construction is booming, cafes are packed. KFC just opened its first Palestinian branch. In the last few years, GDP has grown about 9% in the West Bank. But the numbers are misleading, says Palestinian-American businessman Sam Bahour. He says Israeli military checkpoints and roadblocks have turned a 20-minute drive to Bethlehem into a two-hour ordeal.
I eat more sandwiches on the road, I hit more potholes, I use more gas. For GDP, that's great. And for my livelihood, that's a disaster. For the ability for us to create an efficient economy, that's a disaster.
While Gaza's economy has been severely crippled for years, the World Bank says the Palestinian West Bank is ready for statehood. Not all the institutions are in place, but Palestinian leaders have built a monetary authority that acts like a central bank. There are new income tax laws. There are anti-corruption efforts to go after white-collar crimes. At a downtown rally in favor of the UN bid, IT worker Murad Rumani said his people are ready for their own independent state.
We have a good government and we have a good infrastructure and we have a lot of things, more than Somalia, for example. And Somalia is a country. Why we don't have it?
It raises the question, what really makes a country anyways? The Palestinians don't control their imports and exports or have their own currency. But in recent years, they have equipped themselves with the trappings of a modern country. They have their own internet domain name, .ps. They stopped using the Israeli International Dialing Code, 972, and got one of their own, 970. Businessman Ibrahim Barham proudly gave me his business card.
Some people, when we travel in the world, what is this 970? So they're asking us. It's Palestine, so it's an address.
But a symbol is still just a symbol. Palestinian businessmen still want their political leaders to finally negotiate with Israel for a real independent state. In Ramallah, I'm Daniel Estrin for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Allianz, providing investment, insurance, and retirement solutions through its affiliated companies in the U.S. since 1896. AllianzUSA.com. By Best Buy for Business, always thinking of ways to help you get ready for business. More at BestBuyForBusiness.com. And by Putnam Investments, helping to solve tomorrow's retirement savings challenge. This is Putnam Today. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note from the Marketplace, this just sounds way too weird, File. Researchers at the University of California at Berkeley sat some volunteers down, had them watch movie clips, and scanned their brain activity. And then, from those impulses, a computer was able to make rough reconstructions of what they saw. Only crude shapes and movements, mind you. Nothing as identifiable as a face, for example. And no, they weren't trying to find a way to make cheap movies. One day, they suggest this might help, say, stroke victims who have no other way to communicate. Never in my wildest dreams. And that's Marketplace from APM, American Public Media. Today, the Dow plunged 391 points, 3.5%. The NASDAQ took off 82 points, 3.25%. The S&P 500 lost 37 points, 3.1%. Ben Adair, John Buckley, Nancy Fargali, Stephen Gregory, John Hawes, Patty Hirsch, Jonathan Karp, Betsy Streisand, and Lisa Tucker are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is George Judson. Tune in tomorrow to the Marketplace Morning Report for the latest in business and economic news. And next time on this program, what a week. Republicans pressure the Fed, another wild one for the Dow. And anybody notice, do we have a jobs bill yet? It's the weekly wrap. I'm Bob Moon. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow. This is APM, American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.